live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, a little different program. The latest on health and healing, what we can expect from honey that's new and improved. The Mediterranean diet is cutting heart disease big time. And then we're going to look at milk and prostate cancer, a connection, drinking black tea and decreasing diabetes. Even low-dose carnitine can yield weight loss. So we have a lot to share on the health area, always some peer-reviewed journal. Then a little longer commentary than normal. Today, I am presenting an original commentary, Liberalism's Death Bell Tolls. And hopefully you will share it with others if you find it meaningful and a representation of the reality that we live in. So please let your friends know that I'll be sharing this in about 15 minutes. Now, if there is time after that, I intend to share a commentary by Dr. Glenn Berry. The Earth is dying, yet climate and force movements lack urgency and substance. This is a real challenge to the environmental movement. And Dr. Glenn Berry is an internationally recognized political ecologist, environmental advocate, and he is well known within the environmental community as a leading global ecological visionary. And he is also one of the advocates for we taking back environmental issues and working at the grassroots level. So if time permits, let's begin. Honey is the only food that cannot go bad. It is also probably the oldest used natural medicine. In fact, throughout time, in all the different thousands of years, it's probably saved more lives from infections that would have killed someone than anything else used, up until the use of antibiotics. Here is the latest. And this is how it fights cancer. And this is from university at the United Arab Emirates University. They found that honey from New Zealand's manuka tree can effectively inhibit the growth of cancer cells, including breast cancer, skin, and colon cancer, and tremendously reduce the toxicity associated with chemotherapy. Quote, from their study, from the Department of Medical Microbiology and Immunology, College of Medicine and Health Sciences, manuka honey has been recognized for its antibacterial and wound-healing properties for many years. However, the potential effects of manuka on cancer cells has not been investigated in detail. The evidence so far suggests that manuka acts by stimulating a number of proteins inside the cell that leads to the induction of apoptosis, or programmed cell death. This is a natural process by which our body eliminates old or unwanted cells and is part of the normal organism's development. That's according to the study. Quote, it is significant that a honey can do this. The manuka honey alone can inhibit cancer growth by 30%. So that's good news. One more reason that we should be using manuka honey. And a lot of reasons we should be following a Mediterranean-type diet. Now, for those of you who've been in the Mediterranean, especially the Western Mediterranean, you know that several things are part of this. First, they're really into lots of living foods. It's very common to find large bowls of fruit on the table all the time. Finishing a meal with a piece of fruit is common. Small serving sizes. In fact, for a lot of Americans, they're not used to getting one plate after another plate after another plate of food. They're used to throwing everything on one plate. The Mediterranean way of eating, whether it's in Greece or Spain or France or Italy or Portugal, is to eat one small dish, take your time, eat another small dish, and you'll have your salad in there, a soup. You'll have an antipasta, sometimes with lightly grilled and then baste it in olive oil and herbs, eggplant and zucchinis and onion and garlic roasted. And then a pasta, more often than not a homemade pasta, a whole grain pasta, sometimes fish, not a lot of meat, and what primarily they have, if they're on the Mediterranean, seafood, and always fruit, generally organic red wine, most of it homemade. It's very common to find people who have their own little vineyards. Lots of herbs. Herbs are in everything. And always olive oil. And there are over 150 different types of olive oil. Some are very strong. They're the first cold-pressed, and depending upon the olive time of year, it can almost look like car oil. They have developed a taste for that, but Americans have not. As a result, much of the olive oil over the decades that have been sold in the United States has been filtered or a lighter variety that matches our palates. But if you really want the real, rich, healing olives and olive oil, you go there. Or to a Italian community, Italian-American community, and you'll find stores that sell the real deal. It's not uncommon to sit at a table and to have an appetizer. You either have a homemade bread, and in the middle of the plate you'll have olive oil with seasonings and some balsamic vinegar, and you sop the bread in that and eat it. Or you'll have a plate of olives. I've actually been at a restaurant where I had about 20 different types of olives on a plate. Now, when I was in Germany, and especially in the countryside near Munich, it was just the opposite. You would sit at a Hofbräu, an alehouse, where they have a big mug of beer, before dinner. This is in the late afternoon. And the people would sit around big tables, and there'd be like a spinning server. And each cup of that would have a different type of sausage. And the whole idea was that the sausage was made there on site. And if you went out the back, sure enough, you'd see there was a slaughterhouse, and they'd kill the pigs and make the sausage, and right there, and all kinds of sausages based upon the cut of meat and the seasonings used. And they'd have mustard and relishes they'd dip on the plate. And, of course, you see them and big. I mean, really, so much obesity. And I wasn't there to condemn it or criticize it. I was just there to observe it and try to understand it in the context of the culture, the upbringing, the diet. And in the midst of all this, when I was in Germany, I went over to Dr. Hans Klaus Martin's place. And by the way, I just found some photos, and I put them up on my website showing you the trip I made to his anti-aging clinic and showed you where it was in the Bavarian Alps. And it was a beautiful environment. And what I found there was interesting. This is an aside, but it's still kind of instructional. There were 50 Americans there mainly, and most had very unhealthy lifestyles. When I spoke with the different people, were very open about coming there. They were going there so they could get rejuvenated. And they were getting a diet, but more importantly, they were getting live cell injections and live cells from sheep embryos. And they prided themselves in having these organic high pastures where the sheep were hardier, healthier, disease-free, and hence the cells they were implanting into the body. And when I say implant, I mean implant, because it's a huge needle. I mean, it was about as thick as a screwdriver, and they stick that in your ear end. And then they implant the cells, depending upon if you have a bad heart or bad liver, bad kidney, bad spleen, bad pancreas. That's what they gave you. And it was expensive, relative to everything else. I guess today it would not have been. I think it was about $5,000. And when I looked at the food, the emphasis was upon lots of bitter drinks, the bitters. Now, that's something that's not German, that's Swiss. And Dr. Niehans, who had brought that concept of the bitters clear out the debris in the body. They can chelate out heavy toxins. So they had a lot of these herbs, specially grown. I went to the place where they were grown. Beautiful. Landscaped gardens on the sides of hills where you'd have every kind of bitter herb. And they would go pick them fresh, and then they would make concentrates out of them or juice them in this little wheatgrass juicer. And then these people throughout the day would be drinking this bitter juice and then sitting in mineral water. That was a big thing everywhere in Europe. Sitting in mineral water is big. In the United States, we don't even sit in a bathtub. What's that? That's a bathtub. What's in it? That's water. Should I drink it? No, you can sit in it. Really? So anyhow, a bidet in the United States, most people think it'd be a water fountain. So I watched all this. And to me, the most interesting part was that not a single person, not one, that I interviewed, was willing to make any changes whatsoever in their lifestyle. If they smoked or drank, did drugs, whatever they, bad diet, they all had bad diets. The idea was this was a magic panacea. Take this and you don't have to make any other changes. And I thought, isn't that, and so I remember there was one woman who founded a food chain, and I said, do you notice, oh, this is so important. When I go back for the next 3 or 4 or 5 years after I go back, I just feel so much energy. I look better. My body's better. Well, what would happen if you actually stopped smoking and drinking and ate healthier? How much better would you be? Then you wouldn't have to come back here every 3 to 5 years. But the notion was, why change? There's a pill. Or in this case, there's an implant. But such an enormous difference between that in Germany and some of the anti-aging spas in Italy, where the food is extremely important, and the exercise and the mineral waters and drinking mineral water all day long. They keep giving you these glasses throughout the whole day and relaxing. Different, same, not far apart, but very different in how they approach. Well, of course, the healthier way is the Mediterranean diet. Nobody lives a long life with this German diet as a statistical part of the population. But the Mediterranean, yes, it is considered the healthiest diet for a region and a large group of people in the world. The Japanese diet also is for the traditional older Japanese population, the younger population are have all the diseases you would expect from anyone who has been Americanized in their diet and lifestyle. This is the latest. And the results of this very large and long-term study, it was a 7-year study, and it's considered a landmark study. And this was also done in association with others and published in New England Journal of Medicine. And here's what it says. It says, people following an energy unrestricted plant-based diet, that's your vegetarian diet, supplemented with extra virgin olive oil and nuts, can reduce their risk of a major cardiovascular event by 30% compared to people just following a purely low-fat diet. So that is a big deal. Now just imagine, how hard is it just to put some extra virgin organic olive oil in your diet each day? It's not. You could pour it over your brown rice, pour it over a salad. And this was at a seminar, the International Congress of Vegetarian Nutrition at Loma Linda University. In the single-blind, randomized clinical trial, they followed 7,477 volunteers, 55 to 80 years of age, who were at high risk of cardiovascular disease, but with no symptoms. And see, there's the key. A lot of people think they're healthy because they don't have the chest pain, they haven't had lightheadedness or headaches. They think, well, there's no big deal. There is a big deal. And they did not restrict the calories. Now, I've said this 1,000 times. If you're really eating healthy, you don't focus upon calories, because your healthiest food is your low-calorie, high fiber foods. So you could eat a bucketful of salad. You're not going to gain weight from that. And if you have fresh fruits, like an orange, an apple, Not a lot of calories in that. And if you eat healthy nuts, there are some calories in that, but there are good fats in that. But you're filled up already. It's when people eat a big steak with all that fat and all the protein and all those calories, that's when the calories count. And when you have empty calories like sugar, that counts. So they didn't restrict calories, and the stroke level went down also significantly when they added the olives and the nuts. And you see all kinds of nuts, pine nuts in particular, in the Italian diet. So one more reason that we should be having the Mediterranean diet as a part of our vegetarian diet. It's a good transition diet for a lot of people. A lot of people are not going to go from eating a lot of meat and unhealthy meats and eating them in an unhealthy way to simply a vegan, an organic healthy vegan. You try that, you've just lost, I'm going to guess, 90% of the people who would otherwise make an effort. If, however, you respect that human nature is going to change in its own time and at its own pace without being pressured, then you have transition points. And the more transition points you provide people, the more likely it is, from my experience, that they'll go ahead and take another step and another step. Now, these may be small steps to some, but for those who are trying to make a change, encourage them, congratulate them when they go from regular meat to organic meat and from organic meat to wild fish and from wild fish to a vegan diet. Most people need transition, and if you're self-righteous, if you're doctrinaireing with them, all you're going to do is turn them off. And that's why the vegetarian-vegan movement has been such an abysmal failure, because of so much self-righteous and posturing and elitism and almost like police, food police. So drop all that if you really want to help other people, because it doesn't work. And having counseled over 75,000 people and having reached tens of millions of people, and getting all the feedback I do, people are going to make the changes that they believe they can, and all the support you give them makes an enormous difference. And finally, antioxidant improves the donated liver survival rate more than 90%. Now, this is from Science Daily, and here's what it says. Researchers from Italy have found that the antioxidant in acetylcysteine, NAC, when injected prior to harvesting of the liver, significantly improves graft survival following transplantation. Results published in the peer-reviewed journal Liver Transplantation, a journal of the American Association for the Study of Liver Disease, suggest that the NAC effect on early graft function survival is higher when suboptimal organs are used. So that's good news. Again, you think all the doctors in America and all the specialists know this? They don't. So anything we can do to share that information that helps them help their patients, happy to do it. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment with an original commentary. Please stay with us.
You know love makes the world go round, and love, baby, makes the seesaws go up and down, and it makes...
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Have you... I'm sure this audience in particular has seen how often we are mandated to have changes in our lives where rules and laws that have been in place to protect us and the environment, our water, our air, our soil, have been taken away. And we ask why. And other rules that are very draconian that in effect almost accuse us of being unpatriotic if we challenge how our money is spent, especially on the military-industrial complex, or the bloated bureaucracy of our prison system and the privatization of prisons. And why are you putting someone in jail for, you know, using or having a small amount of marijuana. What's the point of that? At $60,000 or more per person per year in the destruction of their life, how does anybody benefit from that? Well, of course, people do. And behind almost everything that's bad in public policy at the state level in the United States is a very nefarious organization called ALEC. Most Americans are not familiar with ALEC. So I want to just share a short clip, and you can watch it on our Gary Nall TV about ALEC, and then I'll do my commentary. By the way, also, for those of you who are needing some life counseling to help you with some of the emotional issues that you're dealing with, depression, anxiety, eating disorders, weight control, fatigue, Dr. Nadia's back, and she is helping people, and her service is free. I pay her a very nice salary, so you don't have to pay her anything, and you can drop by in the afternoon and see her, and just call to make sure that she is there at 212-874-4000. Now for ALEC.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey.
Tough break, Billy Boy, but there's a new way to make laws these days. ALEC the name, and you better not have scratched the limo, pal. See, it works like this nowadays. Bunch of corporations get together and get tax write-offs for bankrolling a charity called the American Legislative Exchange Council. Sounds pretty official, huh? Then they schmooze and booze a whole lot of politicians from states all over the country at posh hotels. Corporate bucks also buy scholarships for politicians. If you're a scholar of drinking scotch, smoking cigars, and playing golf at a resort. So now there's suddenly one big happy family. The corporations, the lobbyists, the politicians. They all get together far away from your citizens and voters, and the unelected lobbyists secretly vote with the politicians, as equals, of course, on the things the corporations want to do. Like, get clean air and water rules, raise your credit card rates as high as they want, crush them democratic unions, make it easier to get away with shooting people, and privatize schools, prisons, bail, immigration, and what have you. Hell, they've privatized their own mothers. So once the politicians have been wined and dined, a little campaign contribution here, a good time there, the politicians, legislators, head back to their capitals or Congress and fast-track as many of these bills as they can. And here I am, a model ALEC bill, soon to be law. It's a hell of a lot easier and more fun than how you used to do it with all those regular old citizens and meddling media watching your every move. Face it, you're washed up. Corporations have made government of the people obsolete, Bill. It's a thing of the past. What do you have to say for yourself, you old dreamer?
Please help.
I gotta stand my ground on you right here, put you out of your misery.
Now for an original commentary. Liberalism's death knell. The rudiments of neo-fascism stole into American politics during the presidency of Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. At that time, government discovered that serving the private corporate sector was more profitable than serving American citizens. For example, if people were faced with eviction due to back mortgages, or were unable to scrape together a standard of living based on current wages, then it was irrelevant whether or not the conservative or liberal ideologues and policy wonks had their best interests at stake. At the end of the day, people found themselves homeless, on the street frequently, or couch surfing, or applying for food stamps, or working two jobs. They couldn't afford to get sick or send their children to the colleges they wanted, or at all, and it was very unlikely that they were able to retire when that time arrived. American citizens were gradually indoctrinated to believe that either all of the nation's problems resulted from too much federal spending, or conversely, arose from too little government expenditure. The Reagan and the Bush regimes told us we must protect the wealth and the free market rich, because it would be from this tiny class of wealthy and powerful that jobs would trickle down, creating a free market that would benefit everyone. However, according to the Reagan agenda, For this scheme to work, it was also necessary to cut back social entitlements, to lessen taxes, and eliminate as many federal and state regulations as necessary. At the same time, the Reagan-Bush conservatives had no reservations about launching ever larger increases in government and military spending, as well as providing tax relief and other subsidies for major corporations, including big oil, big nuclear, big pharma, big food, big agri, big insurance, and big finance. On the flip side, liberals were historically the champions of the working class and unions and civil rights and social welfare and women's rights and the anti-war movement. However, during the Clinton presidency and now under Obama, the liberal agenda has removed firewalls such as the Glass-Steagall Act, passed regressive free trade treaties, think NAFTA and GATT, and soon the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and now again increasing military spending. These measures ultimately destroyed unions, offshore jobs, reduced the standard of living, continued the Republicans' ghettoization of America, and granted foreign corporations sovereign rights over the exploitation of America's labor and resources. And while the conservatives have regressed to a pre-Enlightenment anti-scientific mindset, the denial of climate change being a perfect example, the liberal left refuses to acknowledge the severity of climate change and address it. And as a result, we can face only catastrophic consequences because it is contrary to the myth of infinite growth and progress that is the backbone of the corporate agenda. In the meantime, the major media, television, magazines, partisan talking heads blame each other for the country's cultural collapse and its social and economic illnesses. Neither has shown an effort to be self-reflective and accept how each has contributed to the problems. Therefore, we accuse both corporate Democrats and Republicans and corporate liberals and conservatives for being complicit in manipulating America's economy, political and social structures in order to meet the financial ends at expense of the health and well-being of the nation. How did the liberal left in America get it so wrong? When did it become so powerless in addressing the avalanche of crisis facing the nation? At what point did it lose its moral bearing and compromise on its fundamental principles that at one time were truly progressive and democratic for all? Starting in the 1960s and continuing for several decades, America witnessed an unprecedented surge in educated young adults in the workforce. As the years passed, more and more men and women saw the neoliberal corporate agenda as a path to economic prosperity. It seemed to highlight a roadmap for an American dream, promised by the preceding great generation. By the time the Reagan Revolution arrived, the political philosophies of Democrat and Republican parties were secondary. What had become primary for the new best and brightest class, who now perceived themselves as intellectually superior, was personal advancement. Historically, members of the professional educated class occupied positions in the establishment and government that promised economic security during the course of a career and through retirement. Consequently, a large percentage of the professional class became an invisible population of mutes. Following the Peter Principle, a popular publication in 1969, a person would continue to be promoted through the capitalist hierarchy as long as he or she remained competent to their goals. In essence, a person graduated to his highest level of competency, but where they would never become policymakers and would not take blame for any mistakes. Yet, he was distant enough from the working class in the same environment to convince himself that the job they were doing was protected. This allowed millions of the professional class to become corporate technocrats. And hence, the cancer begins. Then there is a game changer. In the mid-1970s, when the heads of multinational corporations and banking firms, the captains of industry and the trust babies, like think Rockefeller, the Fisks, the Mellons, were no longer the only privileged class of policymakers who controlled the advancement of those in their industries and set the national, state, and local policies, a new class had emerged comprised of vulture capitalists who not only wanted their piece of the pie, but believed they were brighter and more worthy than the industrial and financial moguls from the preceding generation. At the fore of this group were corporate raiders such as T. Boone Pickens, Carl Icahn, Saul Steinberg, equity kings like Henry Kravitz, and the junk bond traders like Michael Milken. These and others, such as Bain Capital, the Carlyle Group, and the Texas Pacific Group, were among the architects of a new financial paradigm that rapidly changed the way business was done and, as a result, looted the nation. This new class of financial mavericks saw the advantage of taking financially solvent companies with little debt and quality products and reputations and buying an interest in the companies until they controlled them and, as a result, were able to outsource them. The results were thousands of companies loaded with such debt that they could not be serviced, and that it was easier to justify moving the company overseas. This meant the loss of numerous jobs to America and the economic destruction of American communities. This was a recurrent pattern by both Democrat and Republican for nearly 40 years. Between 2000 and 2010, 58,000 factories were closed, but little tracking was done for all those closed from the mid-1970s to 2000. The new vulture capitalists took immense risks regardless of who would absolutely be devastated by the success. And as a result, they had an impact upon a nation. In his book, The Capitalism Papers, Gerrymander calls this neoliberal economic ideology amoral and undemocratic because its sole purpose is to increase the wealth and avoid its distribution. Considering the damage to individuals and society left in the wake of pursuing fortune at any expense, it's clear that such practices are also profoundly immoral. Unlike the industrialists from the previous generation, the new elite was solely concerned with making money off money and developing schemes to leverage debt in order to gain greater profit margins. By securing Wall Street bridge loans for equity partnerships, the new paradigm decimated otherwise financially stable private and public firms that at one time contributed to America's real growth. After saddling corporations they had purchased with unsustainable debt loads and pushing the limits of downsizing, corporate executives and financiers realized it would be much more lucrative to ship the work overseas. They could build a company in China or India or any other developing country, hire cheap labor, export the product back to the United States, and in time, destroy the domestic competition. Aside from workers being laid off and no longer finding a need for their skills easily in the United States, this downsizing trend remained fairly invisible for years. For the media and policymakers, if they had honestly revealed how the new financial titans made their profit, well, then we would have seen how destructive their practices would have been. These were the formative years for the elite that we now call the 1% to stake their claims. The new elite's excitement was directed towards the numerous opportunities promised from a new global workforce of cheap labor. In the meantime, the big box stores phenomena, Walmart and Target, started to proliferate the landscape. The elite flourished through a network of financial firms and corporations and boards and institutions and lobbying firms with direct access to the White House and the Capitol. This web guaranteed their wealth and power would increase and pave the way for the rise of the oligarch 1%. When President Clinton entered the White House in 1992, political affiliation was already rapidly turning irrelevant. The best and brightest Democrats and Republicans were now corporatized, and together they worked through a grid of coalitions. The rhetoric of liberal versus conservative became a smokescreen as politicians aligned themselves with private industry to further their careers. The signing of the Marrakech Agreement, which formally gave birth to the World Trade Organization, as well as the flurry of neoliberal trade agreements, GATT, NAFTA, TRIPS, etc., advanced the new elite's consolidation over domestic and global wealth. Recall how blind most of the liberal left were to the profound flaws in the Clintons' fiscal and economic and environmental policies during the boom years. The Clinton administration and technocrats surrounding him functioned in a fog of corporate interest. with the moral integrity of meth heads, the Clinton White House and the Bush-Cheney regime to follow advance the transformation of once vibrant American cities of industry into bankrupt wastelands, rusting factory ghost towns, crumbling infrastructure from the Atlantic Pacific, and decaying communities and neighborhoods. President Obama has continued this agenda with even less transparency than his predecessors. However, the destruction didn't stop there. The oligarchs of private industry demanded far more control and started to seed think tanks and nonprofit organizations and legions of educated doctorates and academics, the media networks, and the armies of propagandists and lobbyists to shape public opinion. The goal was to assure that government would never side with the American public, never do the right thing, ever, on anything. It would always and forever serve the immorality of the ruling elite. Now that the Occupy movement as a challenge to inequality has collapsed, and the liberal left has proven to be a failure as a coherent moral and constructive energy for bringing forth beneficial social and political change, the myth of the 1% versus the 99% needs to be reevaluated. Should the 1% only be understood according to how much they are personally worth on a tax return? No. If President Obama, Hillary Clinton, John Boehner, and Paul Ryan, and practically every other elected official in Washington pushes for legislation to benefit the 1%, then why should it be assumed that they embody the needs of the 99%? It has been transparent. They have always voted the wrong way. They have supported the wrong policies. And yet people blindly, obediently, almost with a cult-like mindset, just nod and agree. Weighing America's domestic social struggle solely as an economic war misses the significance of a parallel morality play for power. The 1% should also be considered in relation to the massive army of human resources protecting and supporting its control. It does not live by itself alone. TARP and other backdoor banking bailouts, that gave him $20 trillion. Obama's national defense authorization to advance Washington's police state agenda. Exponential growth in the cybersecurity and intelligence industries. The fossil fuel cartel. Out-of-control hydrofracking for natural gas. Expanding military bases abroad and building more privatized prisons. Agrochemical agriculture and GMOs. The corrupt medical establishment that provides Americans with the worst health care in the developed world. And so much more could not have been possible without tens of millions of willing, complicit, conscious Americans all working together for their own selfish means. That is the new face of fascism. This includes the 2.1 million civilians, many of whom working in the federal government in one area. There's an additional 1 million operating within the intelligence agencies, 1.4 million serve in the armed forces, another 20 million private citizens work in corporations, academic institutions, and laboratories deeply tied to the problems being outlined. Mainstream media, which has the mandate to truthfully report about this vast network of power, venom, and hypocrisy, instead protects this regime by keeping the public confused and terrified. We are now witnessing the results of this betrayal, as democracy is silently being dismantled. Finally, another 20 million Americans, one-third of them retired, are apathetic about the direction of the nation and remain soundless. Thought they had financially sound? Well, many living in gated communities and for most purposes have removed themselves from any form of political and social activism. When we add this support base to the greed and narcissism that frames the 1%, we realize the psychopathology extends far beyond the elite alone. Hence, you best understand it's not 1% that's causing this problem. It's about 15%. 44 million people, that's 15% of the population, are added to the formula for who controls the major stakes of power, wealth, influence, and policymaking today. We can be more easily understood why Obama can break almost every campaign promise and consistently deceive Americans openly, yet not be held accountable by his base. without the additional 15% passively serving the most powerful 1% and not holding them accountable, life in the U.S. would be far more democratic and safe. Instead, the U.S. has become what Norman Solomon confirmed recently, the evil that Representative Barbara Lee warned about on the floor of Congress 3 days after 9/11. How the liberal left became irrelevant. In 2012, liberalism handed Obama a second chance to honor his earlier campaign slogan, Change We Can Believe In. And once again, following Obama's inauguration and State of the Union speeches, the liberal left fell for the Obama charm. It forgave Obama for many broken promises during his first term. It forgot his habit of saying anything to please anyone to win support. What is obscene in this gesture was the liberals' hubris in pardoning Obama for a litany of betrayals, policies, and executive orders and secretive negotiations against the American people for which the president never sought forgiveness. This was supposed to be the administration that would be unquestionably committed to accountability and transparency. However, the Obama regime has already far exceeded its GOP predecessor in the number of documents classified, secret, and the number of Freedom of Information Act requests denied. Almost 500,000 were denied since Obama was in office in 1 year alone. Nassim Taleb, author of The Black Swan, wrote, "Charm is the ability to insult people without offending them." And this is the kind of disdain Obama has displayed towards American citizens who have kept him in power. As 40,000 people stood in the cold on the National Mall to demand that the Obama administration make significant efforts to address climate change before the planet reached a point of catastrophic environmental freefall, Obama judged that golfing with Tiger Woods would be a higher personal priority. The irony of these polar images represents the arrogance and self-obsession Obama has shown towards power and domination and his callous disregard for the voices of environmental sanity that can see the big picture over and beyond the technocrats hovering about the White House's inner sanctum. Central to Obama's agenda for hope for America were his proclamations about political party compromise. Since the GOP, the Fox Network, and neocon media, the billionaires behind the Tea Party and ALEC, and the private corporate elite controlling the political right already proved themselves morally bankrupt and traitors for democracy and freedom, why would compromise be thought as a means to inaugurate the kind of urgent changes necessary to restore balance and harmony in the nation? So we must ask, what happens when ideas that are sensible and life-affirming compromise with failure and deception? What is the point? This is the real Obama deception, a charm and intellect that shields a deep and frightening moral weakness to act according to the higher ideals of love and compassion that could change the direction of the nation and lessen the insanity and maliciousness that has become our national anthem. Moreover, the duplicity that now characterizes the White House is equally rife throughout the American liberal left. In 2008, candidate Obama ran on a promise of stronger government accountability and greater transparency. His promises also included government making private industry accountable on condition of receiving public funding. Whenever we find corruption in the world today, we also find a lack of accountability and transparency. This is the code behind all criminal cartels and syndicates, and it is massively pervasive. During a TED Talk, Trinidadian economist and activist Afra Raymond defined corruption as such: abuse of trust for the benefit of yourself, friends, and financiers. In a democracy which relies on the expenditure of public funds, corruption manifests when the government secretly funds programs against the will of the people. In such cases, tax dollars go directly to corporate and corporate-sponsored elites that threaten the quality of life rather than protect and preserve it. Having again rallied around Obama, the pseudo-liberal media, the Huffington Post, the entire MSNBC lineup, Alternet, Mother Jones, Daily Cause, and others, has, in Chris Hedges' words, quote, betrayed the core values they, the liberals, use to define themselves: the rule of law, the safeguarding of civil liberties, the protection of unions, the preservation of social welfare programs, environmental accords, financial regulation, a defiance of unjust war and torture, and the abolition of drone wars. During the early decades of the 20th century, This would have been a standard platform of causes to define the progressive agenda with a liberal perspective. Modern progressivism's roots began with La Folliette's Weekly, a publication founded by Senator Robert La Folliette in 1909. Today, the magazine is known as The Progressive and still remains a leading voice against war, militarism, and the oligarchical demands to keep the death machine functioning in Washington. How many major corporations and financial institutions have publicly expressed opposition to the escalation of America's wars and the new lethal military technologies, such as air drones and bioweapons, that have earned the U.S. such disdain and condemnation from other nations and populations around the world? Such companies can't be found because, in a full-blown oligarchy and during a war of economy, they are the government's partners in crime and among the building blocks of the new fascism. The liberal media today finds itself incapable of reporting to Americans the true state of the nation's affairs. Liberalism, corporate liberalism, has failed and will continue to botch efforts to create a reliable story because it has not been able to move beyond the red-blue divide. Its downfall has been its inability to accept and support alternative choices. For this reason, liberals continue to blame, wrongly blame, stupidly blame Ralph Nader for Bush's victory and remain irrationally apologetic to Obama and the Democrats as they did to Clinton. According to the progressive platform, this lunatic argument reconfirms just how impoverished liberalism has become. No longer should we rely on what the liberal left or the conservative right tells us about the state of the nation and America's role in the world. Both institutions are bereft of ethical and spiritual substance. The right suffers from radical superstition and anti-intellectualism that has turned the U.S. into a laughingstock among developed countries. The left suffers from a highbrow intellect conceit and a poverty of spirit that was once and could be again a moral and revolutionary force to relieve suffering and fight on behalf of peace and human and civil rights. I accuse. It is past the time for liberalism to continue to function without a human face. It is time for it to stand accused alongside the conservative and religious right as an ideology dedicated to disaster, capitalism, ecological demolition, environmental collapse, and unending warfare. Progressive ideals and values, which today are nowhere to be found in our halls of power, need to frame the discussion for solutions. These values will not be found in corporate America, Wall Street, or Washington. In the 1890s, the French author Emile Zola accused the French army and then the French president of anti-Semitism, corruption, and cover-up that resulted in the wrongful sentencing of Alfred Dreyfus, a Jewish military officer charged with treason. Zola's letter, entitled I Accuse, and published in a popular Parisian newspaper, fueled a national controversy known as the Dreyfus Affair, which divided France. Many parallels can be drawn between the Dreyfus Affair and the current U.S. political paradigm. In both cases, there is a clash between tyrannical forces of power aiming to repress democracy in favor of security and progressives who believe freedom and the pursuit of happiness trump federal and oligarchical paranoia and megalomaniac economic and social control. In a recent interview on the Progressive Radio Network, religious scholar Andrew Harvey remarked that fierce truth is very hard to speak in America. People are absolutely terrified of the truth at the moment, yet finding ways to tell this truth is the name of the game, and to keep on telling it because the lies ranged against us and it are not and now can be fought. The establishment is hysterical. Zola found his voice, as did Occupy Wall Street and many dedicated progressive journalists and scholars who found the courage to speak against government corruption. Appearing on Tavis Smiley's program, Professor Cornel West stated that the hard truth that the majority of Americans refuse to accept. He said, quote, "Let us not be deceived. Nixon, Bush, Obama, they're war criminals. They have killed innocent people in the name of the struggle for freedom, and they're suspending the law, very much like Wall Street criminals. The law is suspended for them, but the law applies for the rest of us," end quote. Similar accusations have been made repeatedly by international legal scholars, such as the international law war crime expert Francis Boyle, former president of the National Lawyers Guild Marjorie Cohen, and many other progressives who have moved beyond the blue-red divide, a partisan politics, and champion human rights, nonviolence, economic equality, and right of humans to have access to resources essential to life. Although most alternative media, liberal media, such as the Huffington Post, and The Nation disagree on particular policies coming forth from Obama, when election time arrived, they abandoned their principles and chose to bolster the president's image as the lesser of two evils and our only viable choice. Given the ease with which they betrayed their stated ideals, we must call into question the integrity of the liberal establishment and ask, is it wise to compromise? Just as there is deception behind Obama's doctrine of compromise, so too liberalism has compromised on its higher moral values and has exposed its intellectual conceit and gross defects in character. If you joined the liberal media and voted for Obama, then by extension, in the epigenetics of reality, you are a part of what he has put into motion. Therefore, do not deny that you are complicit and do not look the other way when the consequences of his power and those that support him and he them cause denying the severity of threats due to climate change and global warming, and therefore accepting there is no urgency to take drastic immediate efforts to curb the rate of greenhouse gas emissions, supporting the Keystone tar sand pipeline from Canada to Texas that will destroy the health of countless Americans, result in unimaginable environmental disaster and the pollution of natural resources, supporting the construction of new nuclear power reactors, believing in the myth of clean coal and condoning indiscriminate hydrofracking in environmentally sensitive areas, and allowing these industries to be subsidized by the taxpayer, tolerating illegal wiretapping and a systematic surveillance of Americans by government intelligence agencies in alliance with private cybersecurity corporations, overriding privacy laws so that no citizen is protected any longer from surveillance through monitoring email, phones, and your computer, because every citizen in the government's eyes is a potential threat to the country's security in the war on terrorism, permitting the end of the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878 that forbids the U.S. military from being deployed on domestic soil and acting against American citizens, allowing the U.S. to transform into a police state at every county, state, and federal level, where the police departments are increasingly militarized by the U.S. Armed Forces, whereby they become an extension of the Department of Defense, ordering the silencing and prosecution of whistleblowers in government who come forth publicly to warn of criminal activities and corruption in government agencies that have an adverse effect on Americans' well-being, and stopping them, condoning the arrest and indefinite detention of American citizens based upon suspicion of terrorist affiliation, transforming the civil court system into a military court model that erodes the legal rights of citizens against the government tyranny upon which our legal system is based, continuing the failed war on drugs, the rising incarceration of Americans for small misdemeanors, the privatization of a prison system relying upon infinite growth in inmates, and the criminalization of poverty, acting against the rights of workers and unions, favoring treaties like NAFTA, GATT, and the forthcoming Trans-Pacific Partnership that will further sell out American workers and return to greater profits to overseas corporations, giving preferential treatment to the medial insurance industry, which plays no critical role in prevention and treatment of disease, allowing every child in America to be screened for psychological illnesses, to support a psychiatric industry that is based on non-science, allowing the private agrochemical industry headed by Monsanto and DuPont to write the agricultural laws in this country so that genetically modified crops and organisms are considered safe for humans and animal consumption and carry no risk to the environment, denying the Federal Reserve's role in demolishing America's middle class and protecting Wall Street's oligarchy control over the Fed and the U.S. Treasury, and flooding the world with cheaper dollars, judging Wall Street's banks more worthy of forgiveness to receive debt relief and assistance from taxpayers than debt forgiveness to Americans who are underwater in their mortgages, credit, student loans, and small business debts, ignoring the laundering of drug money and criminal funds through major Wall Street banks and the federal government's willingness to prevent the prosecution of bank executives who oversee these financial transactions, increasing America's military budget at home and abroad rather than feeding the nation's starving children and dealing with the growing number of homeless who have suffered at the hands of the government compliance with Wall Street ignoring the need of congressional investigations and hearings into former Bush-Cheney administration invasions of sovereign countries and subsequent crimes against humanity, condoning torture against the international rules set forth by the Nuremberg trials and the Geneva Convention, contributing to the thousands of homicides and suicides committed by American soldiers and veterans who have been abused and forgotten by the U.S. government during the Afghan and Iraq wars, ordering the murder of numerous children, women, and elderly in drone attacks, or a consequence of them, backing despotic regimes with dismal human rights records such as Saudi Arabia, complete criminal organization, Egypt, Bahrain, and others, launching sanctions against Iran that are responsible for untold suffering of regular Iranian citizens, fueling hatred of America by nations around the world who now perceive U.S. military aggression as the world's greatest threat to our peace. In conclusion, from the perspective of universal values and higher human ethics, these are among the many faults the administration can be charged with. Many of Obama's supporters will perceive these charges as indicators of progress compared to the Bush years. However, since the liberal media claims to align itself with progressive values, it must be held accountable for its blind ignorance of the regime abuse of power, as well as attacks on alternative candidates who espouse the values of true liberalism. Nobody considers whether Rocky Anderson or Jill Stein's triumph over Obama would have signaled a dramatic conquest of good over evil. Neither Anderson, Stein, or Gary Johnson would have continued the majority of Obama's policy I just mentioned. Obama's National Defense Authorization Act would be stripped, military bases around the world would be closed, and we would negotiate not as alpha, aggressive males in the military, but rather as true seekers of peace. The rich and powerful would be paying their fair share, and America would be able to understand that corruption by those in power would no longer be acceptable. Until Americans summon the courage to stand up and demand an end to the corporate strong backing of the institutions that now form the new form of fascism, we are almost guaranteed to head down a path that will send our nation, like every other imperial power before it, straight into the dustbin of history. I'm Gary Nall with Richard Gale. We thank you for listening. Now we will take TalkBack, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, and we have Luann Panessi on the line. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. Boy, that was historic. I think people are scraping their brains off the wall after that one. You know, what you're talking about today is very much related to the show, the 7 o'clock show last night. It was absolutely profound. One of the most important things that came away from it was exactly what you were saying. The fact that we've had a collapse of the American psyche, if you will. And I've had some people from the audience email me, and one guy, Michael, from Hicksville, emails me and says, there's a YouTube that shows from Men's Health that says 8 vaccines every man needs to have now, and that becomes our truth. Another member of your audience, Peter, from New York, emails me that a YouTube that shows a school in Huntington, West Virginia, where Chef Jamie Oliver went there to talk to kids about cooking. And what was the most profound thing was these children, Gary, could not identify what a tomato was. They could not identify fresh fruits and vegetables. They didn't know what a radish was. They didn't know even celery. These kids are raised on fast food, and that becomes their truth. That becomes what dictates their lives. And one of the other things you said last night was that we know the price of everything and the value of nothing. Whoa. That's just what we've devolved to. And you also talked about the fact that we've annihilated that sacred connection to universal wisdom. It was an amazing show, and it certainly piqued the reactions of your audience. And a lot of people are waking up to this. And your guest, Andrew Harvey, was talking about the fact that we need this universal revolution. And the more we expose people to the truth, and it becomes so clear and so obvious that the stuff that's been stuffed in their head is just, it's a joke. It's nowhere near the truth. It's it's psychotic. When people understand that, oh, man, it's so much easier to unravel all the junk in their head. I know, because I went through that myself.
I would hope that people download last night's Progressive Commentary Hour and listen to it. There's just two of us for an hour. This was a scholar, religious scholar from Cambridge University, and I talking about spiritual activism. What does it take in order to commit yourself to the cause of truth in anything in your life? And what we both agreed upon was that we've just wasted 30 years. We had the completely stupid New Age movement. We had the faux spiritual movement. We had all the fake gurus, including American gurus, you know, who had come up with popular books, hip notions, like The Secret, and everybody would run around and talk about it. We had spiritual materialism. We didn't have anything authentic in materialism. We had gazillion people running off to retreats and yoga camps, but not changing a single thing that was fundamental to the truth in their lives, just adding something else in, like going down an aisle in a supermarket. But it's I want to feel good about myself supermarket, so I'm going to take some rolfing, and now today I'll take some applied kinesiology. And I'll take what is the latest in don't sweat the small stuff and everything the small stuff. I like that, and I'll take that. And at the end, you get to the checkout counter, and you think, I've got a whole lot of good stuff here. And you think, you didn't need any of this, and none of this is going to help you. This is all just an illusion. It's all an illusion. But it was beautifully packaged as an illusion, and illusions have to be beautifully packaged. They can't come from real knowledge. They can't come from that deep, burning zeal. Was it not Thomas Fuller who said, zeal without knowledge is fire without light? So we have a lot of people who get all up. But up for what? There's no there there. They don't do anything. I can't tell you how many people have written me and spoken to me about how they like this, and you know they're firm about that. And I said, well, friend, tell me exactly how today have you made it a better day for the world? Well, they haven't got around to that. You know, they got to rush off to the yoga now. Sorry, can't take time. You know, they got to go get their colonic. Oh, okay. Remember, most of those within the movements are not true progressives. They're illusionary. It was Somerset Maugham who said it is dangerous to let the public behind the scenes. They are easily disillusioned, and then they are angry with you, for it was the illusion they loved. So for those who want the truth, you got it coming, because you'll be able to make the moves. You'll see the housing crisis coming. I see a 25% collapse in the real estate market coming. I see hyperinflation coming. I see inflation at anywhere from 7 to 10%, possibly 15%. I could go much higher. I see the dollar being lost as a reserve currency. I see people abandoning the dollar in the next 24 or 36 months or sooner. Right now it's strong simply because the euro is in crisis. Because the euro is in a double-dip recession, and it's not going to get better because they're going to have a pushback against all their austerity. It's just a matter of when the pushback comes. And so, but it's all waiting to happen here. But first, we'll live with a complete ghettoization. So we'll have all the worst qualities of what's happening in Greece, but we won't go to the streets as they have in Greece because we're still in that opium dream of believing, if we listen to Rush Limbaugh or Rachel Maddow or Keith Olbermann, that somehow we'll be saved. We won't be. And you will see, between the environment, between the droughts, between the scarcities, between the collapse of our economy, part of our economy at least, and we'll be forced to make changes. The smart ones will be making it at that. We're out of time. Thank you. And now let's say hello to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today we'll be talking about the U.S. Supreme Court case that comes up tomorrow for review. That is the Voting Rights Act. And we'll be talking also with a human rights attorney interested in getting the United Nations to claim responsibility for a cholera epidemic that has afflicted more than 600,000 and has killed more than 8,000 people in Haiti.
Wow, we certainly want to hear that. We look forward to Utrice Lead right now on Progressive Radio Network.